warm summer day 100 years ago, a group of Indian men gathered on tribal lands to strategize. At their Lower Sioux Reservation, just up the steep banks from the nearby Minnesota River, these young Padawakantuan Dakota glimpsed across a field at a huddle of white men, similarly making plans. One group that was clear would be on the offensive soon, and the Indians were prepared to seize the initiative. Grabbing some nearby wood planks and swinging them sharply above their bodies, Native leaders Alex Campbell, Frank Bluestone, and Charles Webb Thunder urged their indigenous brethren toward the imminent encounter. 2 hours later, it was all over. A white Indian clash had indeed resulted in victory for the Dakota. Yet following this triumph, Natives and Euro-Americans mingled and conversed on the Lower Sioux land. The Ballland, it seemed, was a good place to visit with friends. True, this 1910 baseball game was billed as a match between supposedly antagonistic rivals, Indians versus Morton Whites. But in reality, players on both teams knew each other well from past seasons on the same roster. Familiarity and cooperation indeed proved widespread among white and Dakota ball players at this southwestern Minnesota locale. But other less friendly themes also emerge. As this essay shows, the story of baseball at Lower Sioux Indian Reservation reveals both the alliance-building efforts of Dakota peoples and their white Morton neighbors, as well as the inherent advantages Euro-Americans held while pursuing, and sometimes by manipulating, the national pastime. Long before the origins of Lower Sioux Reservation, Siouxian peoples called the Minnesota River Valley home. Originating as a people at the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi Rivers near present-day St. Paul, according to tribal creation stories, the Dakota lived along the former Cloudy Sky waters from at least the early 17th through the mid-19th centuries. By that time, however, the signing of treaties ceding millions of acres of tribal land and the quickening influx of Euro-American settlers were changing Dakota life ways dramatically. In 1862, mounting hunger and hostility, American leaders for withholding promised annuities led hundreds of Dakota peoples to wage war on white citizens throughout southern Minnesota, causing tragedies all around. Hundreds of settler families killed, 38 Indian warriors hung in Mankato, and the brutal eviction of all Dakota peoples from this new state. Once prosperously dwelling throughout these northern prairies, the outlook then appeared bleak for Minnesota Sioux. Time, however, did much to heal the war's wounds. Within 25 years of the conflict, white farmers deceded some river valley lands as Dakota peoples, departing their Nebraska exile locale, bought up plots near their old Minnesota reservations. By 1900, nearly 200 Padawakantuan Dakota had relocated to the historic Lower Sioux grounds just across the river from the recently founded town of Morton. These Indians would soon discover just how comfortable they might become in their new homes. Accompanying the Dakota's return to Minnesota was a seemingly unrelated trend, the rise of town team baseball throughout the state. In the Minnesota River Valley, small town baseball flourished as early as the 1890s, with regular contests evident in Morton by 1895. And right from the onset, white and Dakota players intermingled in pursuing a pastime both came to regard as their own. By the early 1900s, for instance, Indians Alex Prescott, Alex and George Campbell, and Charles Good Thunder figured regularly on Morton town team rosters. And a decade later, Dakota minister and community leader Henry St. Clair was umpiring Morton town team games. This ethnic intermixing proved advantageous on the diamond, as an influx of native talent spurred Morton's ball club to region best 9-3 and 10-4 records in 1905 and 1907, respectively. In a locale where Indian and white communities were in several ways dissimilar, most native peoples spoke Dakota, for instance, and some still lived in traditional teepees. Integrated baseball was a valuable asset to both Morton and to the Lower Sioux community, boosting collective performance and establishing partnerships across racial lines. This inclusionary atmosphere takes on additional significance when considering the ethnic makeup of prominent area ball player Charles Thunder, of mixed African American and Dakota blood, and listed as black in the 1900 U.S. Census. Charles possessed a dark complexion, distinguishing him from some of his Indian brethren, and was occasionally referred to in the local press as a Negro. To the Mdewakantawan, all these racial labels likely held little, if any, significance, for Native tradition included people in a community based on kinship or mutual obligations due to hereditary and intermarried relatives, not on the skin color. Charles Goodthunder, then, who was adopted as a child by Lord Sioux Patriarch Andrew Goodthunder and was raised entirely among the Dakota, would have identified as an Indian, not as the black man, census officials took him to be. For early 20th century Euro-Americans, however, concepts of race were all powerful. Increasingly convinced of the racial superiority of Caucasians and the inherent harms of ethnic intermixing, white Americans, and as this audience well knows, baseball executives, segregated every possible aspect of social life in Diamond Flight. Besides the big leagues, semi-pro clubs in Minnesota also saw a color line imposed. Leaders of town teams in St. Cloud and in Duluth, for instance, dropped African-American pitchers Walter Ball and George Wilson in 1903 after community discomfort with integrated play. Yet at Lower Sioux, the darker-skinned Goodthunder alternated freely between Morgantown teams and Dakota reservation lads for over a decade, beginning in 1901, routinely crossing borders unbridgeable in other parts of the state. Bucking a divergent national trend, then, Morton citizens willingly welcomed Goodthunder when it came to enjoying the national pastime. The language of the local Morton Enterprise newspaper, moreover, further revealed the town's remarkably sympathetic stance toward Native peoples. While national periodicals like Sporting Life reveled in racist sports reporting, Morton's newspaper routinely lavished Lower Sioux clubs with compliments. The Indians are playing a phenomenal ball this season, one 1908 article began, proving their worth as amateur players. 2 years later, the paper embraced Dakota squads as our boys, then remarked that Morton can well be proud of Indian pitcher George Campbell. Importantly, this empathetic baseball coverage spilled over into other warm descriptions of the tribe. Indian celebrations held at Lower Sioux every July 5th, for instance, were deemed considered and patriotic. Contrary to bigoted national reporting, Morton's weekly paper evinced considerable compassion between whites and Indians. One final aspect of baseball demonstrated the remarkable interracial cooperation at Lower Sioux, the Diamond. After playing for years at a ball ground in Morton, Dakota athletes built the Diamond on reservation grounds in 1911 and invited Morton clubs over for competition. Henceforward, Morton Town teams regularly played games on the reservation Diamond, bringing ball clubs from all across southwestern Minnesota onto tribal lands. Importantly, the Native hosts appeared with charged admission to at least some of these on-reservation matches, thus perhaps also generating valuable tribal income during an era of duress for most Indians. In this regard, Dakota peoples too gained from the interconnectedness of Morton and Lower Sioux baseball, reaping the benefits of increased playing opportunities, of deepened white sympathy towards Indians, and perhaps of financial betterment for members of the tribe. 50 years removed from their ancestors' violent eviction from Minnesota, these Mdewakantawan Dakota now use baseball to forge alliances for their future. Beyond its mutually enhancing benefits, however, the national pastime also revealed advantages of a different sort, held exclusively by Morton whites. One such added layer of injury concerned the turbulent life of Indian ball player Alex Campbell. Originally from South Dakota, Campbell was immersed in Lower Sioux baseball circles by age 15, when he began a decade-long stint as area second baseman and renowned power hitter. Yet his diamond exploits masked a competing passion in life, speculating on real estate. Cited as traveling to Sisseton, South Dakota in 1907 to look after his land interests there, Campbell's risky habit came back to haunt him in the end. After suffering some financial losses in a 1919 real estate deal, he purchased the cartridges for his rifle, wrote his wife and two children a note, and shot himself in the head. Sadly, Campbell's newfound American future, complete with notions of individual property ownership and financial risk-taking, had usurped many communal values of his people's tribal past, ultimately leaving his bereaving family to wonder if changes in Indian lifeways necessarily meant changes for the better. Alex Campbell was not the only one involved in Lower Sioux baseball to take a gamble. Indeed, in white mountain spectators, like many sports enthusiasts nationwide, wagered vigorously on contests like horse racing and baseball games. Indians, too, loved betting and had done so with lacrosse matches for hundreds of years. At Lower Sioux Reservation, however, diamond wagering took on ominous racial overtones. Local fans are placing their money on the Morton Indian baseball team these days, the Enterprise wrote in 1910. The Indians are playing fastball this season, and our fans are making neat sums of money on them. Suddenly, the co-beneficial relationships forged through baseball took on an ulterior motive. Euro-Americans refashioned native ball clubs into instruments of financial gain. Importantly, this betting reference implies an accumulative intent by local whites, a desire to amass dollars for permanent holding that differs sharply from traditional native practice. Anthropologist Thomas Benham explains that for Indian people, who almost always wagered goods, not cash, and bet between themselves, not against whites, wagering tended to redistribute items of value within a community. The Enterprise's remarks, in contrast, voiced pleasure at white residents' consistent acquisition, likely disturbing some Indians relatively unschooled in for-profit betting. The capitalistic intentions of white Mortonites then suggest a conscious finagling of the relationship with their native neighbors, and shows that local whites were not above capitalizing on indigenous talent for their own private ends. Beyond even Campbell's jaded biography or Mortonite's diamond wagering, one baseball promotion further illuminated the advantageous position whites held in their ongoing relationships with the Dakota. On at least three instances in summer 1910, the Enterprise advertised upcoming Lower Sioux games with this audacious full-page graphic of a generic Indian man dressed in traditional plains attire grasping a baseball bat, posed to swing the next pitch. That the prominent ballplayer stood aside a square home plate was apparently an unimportant aspect of the design to the newspaper, for its real focus seemed to be on capturing readers' attentions and exciting their imaginations with an unforgettable image linking a timeless Indian past with a recognizable Indian present. Here, local whites figuratively superimposed a sketch of a stoic, fictitious Indian over the actual indigenous residents of Lower Sioux, supplanting the pedestrian truth of intercultural partnership with a much more alluring myth of a noble Indian warrior standing in the batter's box. Exoticism, the enterprise believed would sell newspapers as well as tickets. Yet perhaps the greatest irony of this publishing scheme is that so very little about this all-Indian team would have been exotic. Its roster, for one, included not only well-known Dakota men like Charles Goodthunder, familiar faces to whites, but also featured a white infielder named John Rock, who doubtlessly deflated the team's hyperbolic claim of being all Indian. On top of that, the game's locations at Lower Sioux were also likely familiar to Mortonites accustomed to visiting the reservation routinely for baseball. Truly, then, very few surprises awaited white spectators at these Dakota ball games, despite the newspaper's intimations to the contrary. Coupled with the dissolution of Alex Campbell's life after failed speculations and the profiteering of native teams through diamond wagering, these pictorial allures demonstrated how a heartfelt partnership between two ethnic communities, while enduring based on the desires of both, could also be subtly reoriented to further the wishes of one. Clearly, Lower Sioux's baseball story seems one of a balanced duality. On the one hand, the national pastime brought a myriad of benefits to Dakota peoples and to Morton whites. Rosters of Indian and town teams were filled with both native and white ballplayers, boosting performance on the field. Dakota ballplayers, including Charles Goodthunder, far from being excluded because of their race, found comfortable places to play, as did Morton town teams when they traded the city's ballpark for the reservation diamond. And Morton's increased familiarity with the nearby indigenous community fostered a remarkable goodwill for native peoples and forged partnerships across racial lines. Certainly, the national pastime proved a mutually beneficial endeavor for these Madewakantwan Dakota and for the residents of Morton alike. But Lower Sioux baseball also revealed the disequilibrium that existed in this Indian-white relationship. Ballplayers like Alex Campbell, it was clear, absorbed many aspects of the dominant culture in adopting American lifeways, but the underlying mores of acquisitiveness, financial risk, and violence inherent in his death dampen all assessments of this transformation as purely good. On the ball diamond, white wagering on Dakota play sowed seeds of exploitation, however slight, into a previously established friendship. And the enterprise's employment of generic Indian images in an apparent effort to exoticize their familiar Dakota neighbors may well have strained the bonds of camaraderie hitherto so well established. In this sense, white Mortonites demonstrated their subtle yet powerful advantages in this alliance. Control of the mouthpiece of publication, profit-driven betting aligning with American capitalism, and assurance that others would assimilate to their ways that tilted the baseball balance in their favor, regardless of the results in the field. Diamond alliances, it was clear, remained equally beneficial partnerships only there.
Do we have any questions for Dave?
Is that any relation to the family name you were speaking of? Yes, there is. Andrew Goodthunder, who founded the Lower Sioux Reservation in its second inception. The town of Goodthunder, a small location, is named for him.
Do you know if the baseball diamonds
are on the reservation grounds?
Yes.
I'm not certain if the one that's referenced here in the press is still existing, but at Lower Sioux there are two ball diamonds nowadays. I don't know if they overlap.
Do you know what this kind of relationship continued after years later after World War I?
The last part of the question there, sir, I couldn't hear.
Do you know if the relationship continued in the 20s in the same way or changed between positive and negative?
And the change, or the relationship you're referring to between the town of Morton and the Indian reservation? Yes. Baseball reporting peters out by the 19-teens in the local paper. But certainly Lower Sioux Reservation still exists here and Morton is still across the river. So this relationship has continued into the present day. Whether or not the print in the local paper continued to become a little less tactful, I'm not certain. But the relationship between the two communities continues even now.
Any more questions for Dave? Well, thank you very much, Dave Wallenberg.
Thank you, Dave, for taking us back to the days of baseball that was played on Minnesota Native American soil. We'll be back at 11:15 with our next presentation from John Harnage.